You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Kirsty Manning.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show for you. Go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. Any way that you download podcasts, you can listen to it there. I'd like to talk about some sponsors before we get started. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writer's community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experience. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques, learn from a vast collection of free writing resources, make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at Scribophile.com. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've ever seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into that routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach those word count goals. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. It's forthewords.com. That's the number four, thewords.com. Business Essentials for Writers, How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Business Essentials for Authors is your business 101 guide for the publishing industry. Whether you have never published at all or are looking to take your professional career up a notch in an easy-to-read and conversational way, the book covers the five pillars of business. Meet all the people and jobs in the publishing industry and how they fit together. Building the foundation of your business career, including paths to publication. Understanding sales and marketing in publishing. Establishing all of the operational side of any business, from contracts and intellectual property, working with different tools and technologists, and how to design and build your website. Learning how money works as an author, basic accounting, and making more money. We look at all this and more from a long-term strategic view, how to get the plan done, and the mindset to make it all work together. It's Business Essentials for Writers by James Nettles. Kick. The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1 by John L. Monk. A supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it, and he does, every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Everyday, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed yet likable main character. Kick by John L. Monk. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Kirsty Manning on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called The Song of the Jade Lily. And guys, I'm just telling you, this book blew my socks off in more ways than one. The story itself is captivating, engaging, and a complete page turner. And you know what? The fun thing is, at the end of it, I was smarter than when I began, and that's a real feat. I had fun, and I learned so much more about the world around me, and that is the mark of a great book. Welcome to the show, Kirsty.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you. And we'll just tell everybody up front, we're recording. For me, it's a Friday evening, but you are actually calling from the future. It's Saturday morning for you, isn't it?
Saturday morning in Australia.
So crazy. Well, at least we know that we live through the night, because you're already in tomorrow, so the world doesn't end then. Kirsty, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I think it was in primary school. I, like most writers, I was a really avid reader, and I think creative writing was my favorite subject in class. And I just loved English literature, and I loved writing stories from when I was a little girl.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then I went on to work in publishing, and I studied literature, and then I started noodling around more with poetry and things, and it ebbed and flowed from there. I didn't know. I think once I worked in publishing, I saw how much work it was to actually be a writer. So it took me a few years to get back in the game, I think.
Yeah. Well, but you wanted to work around books and storytelling, huh?
I loved it. I studied honours in English at university and history, and then I worked in publishing. I didn't work in fiction. I worked in non-fiction, but I just loved producing people's stories and looking at the rhythm and the pace and the flow of those stories, and the techniques that you could use to get those out on a page, whether it's a linear narrative or you chop and change or thematically. I learned a lot in those years, and just devoured it all.
I love that you talk about the rhythm and pace of writing. That's one of my favorite things, is when you find an author who has a really unique voice, and the rhythm is one of the things that really stands out to me, that it almost lulls you into another world. It's a crazy thing about writing, that you can have that power, and it's so subtle, and if you don't know to look for it, it just kind of sweeps you up, and you don't know it's happened to you until after it has.
Yes, it is. It's a magical thing when it happens. And I think I grew up in a really remote place in Australia. So if you could imagine, at one stage I was hours from the nearest town or big city on a farm. And my only way into the world as a young girl and then a teenage girl, we lived in town when I was a teenager, but still sort of 5 hours from Sydney, so inland New South Wales. So my only way into the world and onto foreign shores and different times was through books. It was really my entree into the world. And it was just, I found that I was really absorbed by those big kind of epic stories, everything from when I was younger, the Greek myths and legends, to sweeping historical epics. As I got a bit older, you could just lose yourself for hours in stories. And I think when I started to write, there were stories that I aimed to produce, I guess. Yeah.
I had a similar experience growing up in the very rural south of the United States, and not quite as remote as you, but a similar experience, that, you know, to get a glimpse of the greater world, it was absolutely through books. That was the only way to kind of get away from being stranded. You know, do you remember what the first book was that just completely transported you to another place and made you feel like you could do anything? Do you remember what that first story that did that to you was?
I think it was the early Greek myths and legends, because it really, you know, I could taste the herbs on the shore, and picture the rugged mountains in Greece and the azure blue ocean, and also that sense of origin stories. I mean, these Greek gods were they were jealous, they were petty, they were ferocious, but they were they were loving, they were loyal, they were fierce and brave, and they all had a very big origin story. That sense of who am I, where did I come from, how did I come to be that way? I think, and I think so many of my stories go back to those questions. And then I read Peter Carey when I was in school, Oscar and Lucinda, an Australian author that many people in America would know. And there was an image of a glass crystal palace floating down the river. And I just thought, that was just extraordinary. It was just a really moving image of quite a whimsical image of a glass palace floating down a river among the gum trees in Australia. And I just thought, wow, literature can do that to you. And then I read Alice Hoffman and I was really entranced by her whimsy and magic. And then I read Possession by A.S. Byatt when I was at university, and that was a dual time frame story, and that was really the game changer for me. It was this epic book that delved back into the history while telling a contemporary storyline. And it was also a love story, and it was just magnificent. I mean, A.S. Byatt is the master of those multiple time frame books, and I think that really set me on the path.
When you studied English and went to work in publishing, and you said that you realized that there was more work than you were prepared for at the time, but that you would come back around to it. What was that first story idea that brought you back to writing?
I was actually on holidays in France with my family, and we went to an old, I guess, castle, and it was a very workmanlike castle. I mean, there are some magical ones in France, but this wasn't one of those. The walled garden was overgrown and tumbled down, and people had used it a little during the Crusades. And I remember going on a bit of a tour of the place, and the tour guide was showing me around, and I walked up these stairs, up a turret, and these worn stairs. And in Australia, we just don't, apart from out in the landscape, obviously, the built environment that we have is really quite young compared to obviously in Europe. And there were these worn stairs that had been grooved over hundreds and hundreds of years. And I thought, how many people have walked up these stairs? And then I got to the top of the room at the turret, and I just had a vision of a woman, a young woman who lived in that room, and an incident that occurred. And I looked out over the walled garden, and I just had an idea of a character who lived in that room, and then a story was born from there.
Wow. So how long did it take you to get that book out?
I went and did a creative writing course, actually. I did an online creative writing course, and I just sort of noodled around, and I didn't have any idea that book would be published. It took me about a year to write, and then another year working on it and tweaking it and rewriting it, because it was told in multiple time eras. That was kind of my starter book, if you like, and I did it, as I said, with a creative writing course, and then I got some editorial feedback from people I knew in the industry, and I just noodled around, and I had no expectation that that would be published, and then it got picked up in Australia. And in the meantime, I had been on holidays in China with my children, and I had just been blown away by that experience. And when they asked me if I had a second book, I said, I lied, of course, as all writers do. And I said, why, yes, I have one in the making. And I quickly wrote up a synopsis for what would become the Song of the Jay Lily. And actually, you know what? I didn't look at that synopsis again until literally the day that it was due with the publisher, a year and a half later. And it was almost, that story was so in my heart the whole time. It was almost down to the wire as to what I originally wrote in my synopsis.
That's amazing. That first book was The Midsummer Garden, right?
It was The Midsummer Garden, yes.
And you mentioned, and I think I've heard the story before, that you were on holiday with your family and in Shanghai, right?
Yes, and, I was.
And you were walking around the city looking, and you found like a rusty Star of David image on a door or something?
Yeah, we're in Hongku, which is on the other side. It's not the fancy part of Shanghai. There's the Bund, and then there's the French Concession. And then over the other side of the Suzhou Creek is an area known as Hongku. And it's got a lot of the old Long Tan laneway houses in it. And somebody pointed out to me a red door with a rusted on Star of David. It was literally pieces of wire welded together, inset into a door, and there's old Chinese letterboxes around it. And it struck me for two things, because you just don't see religious iconography anywhere in Shanghai or in China. It just doesn't exist under their communist regime. So it's quite unusual. You don't see any religious, I guess, symbols.
Religious or otherwise, just plain.
It's just, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful, obviously Chinese history there,
right.
But they, it's just not something that you see regularly in the street. So I was curious about that. And I went back to the hotel and I was talking to the concierge, and he said that area you're walking through, those few narrow streets, and we're talking about an area that is 1 square kilometer, I guess, of little narrow laneway houses. He said that area you're walking through, that used to be the Jewish ghetto during the Second World War. And I was like, excuse me?
You're like, what?
Jewish ghetto? I was just gobsmacked. And I said, what do you mean the Jewish ghetto? Because I thought I understood. I knew about the Japanese occupation. And we, you know, in Australia, we study the Pacific War to some extent, obviously not enough, because I didn't know this history. And he said, go back to tomorrow, go back down to the end of the Long Tans, and there's the Shanghai Jewish Refugees Museum. And so I went to the museum, and when you arrive, there's a picture of a family fleeing the Holocaust, and there's a man and a woman and his wife and the grandparents, and there's a small child sort of sitting across the man's shoulder, and he's holding one leg. And then all the faces of the Holocaust are like carved almost from mud. It's in bronze, but it looks like mud. It's really soft and gentle of all these faces fleeing. And I was standing there with my three children under 10, looking at this statue of a family fleeing and coming to Shanghai. I mean, can you imagine coming by boat? And I found out there was a wall of names behind it, and there were 20,000 names on that wall. 20,000 people fled Europe and came to Shanghai because it was the only place, apart from the Dominican Republic, that you could go without a visa. And of course, in 1938, 1939, 1940, there was you could have no concept of what arriving in Shanghai would be like off a boat from Italy with a bag full, just one suitcase full of all of your things. I mean, it just must have been the most extraordinary experience, and to walk into a world that was completely different to your own. And don't forget that Shanghai at that time was the most decadent, most elegant, the wealthiest, most fabulous city in the world. And it was divided up into multiple concessions. So there was a Japanese area, there was the international settlement with the Americans and the English, and then there was the French Concession, which has and still does these extraordinary Art Deco buildings, with French plane trees, with restaurants. You know, they've got the best European restaurants, and then all the Chinese, you know, dumpling houses and little holes in the wall with the little Xiaolongbao dumplings with the pleats in the top. And I actually took a food tour with the kids around there because, I mean, the Chinese people just, their food is just extraordinary, the sweet and the sour and the crunch and all the different textures that kind of really, the food is a foray into the Chinese culture, the way they look at balance and sweet and sour and yin and yang, and it just tells you a lot about the culture. So I just spent a week trawling Shanghai, just soaking up, obviously not all the dumplings I could taste in the city, but I've certainly felt like that, but all the culture and the history. And and I thought I wanted to tell a story that was captured historical Shanghai and contemporary Shanghai, because just now it is an extraordinary city. Still, it is a city that evolves and changes, and the Chinese are incredibly sophisticated, incredibly welcoming. They're just a really international and open-minded city, and has always been on the cusp of change and embracing people from different cultures. It's really quite something to see.
Well, one of the hallmarks of a great writer is that when you happen upon these strange occurrences in life, where you're going through Shanghai and you see this Jewish iconography, and then the statue, and then the names, invariably our minds start going to thinking through all of the possibilities, and who were these people that were involved in this exodus to this new foreign magical place, and how long did it take before you started thinking that there was a story there and the character started to come alive to you?
It was straight away, actually. There was a photo in the Jewish museum in Shanghai of three little girls. There was one Jewish girl with two Chinese girls, and the Chinese girl had dimples, and they were all wearing these neat smocks, I guess you would call them, with Peter Pan collars. And I had an idea instantly. Romy and Lee, my two characters, Lee, my local Chinese girl, and Romy, the girl who arrives on a boat from, she's originally from Austria. She flees during Kristallnacht, goes to Italy and arrives in Shanghai. I'm not doing any spoilers here. That's how she comes to be in Shanghai. But I thought, what if I told the story of a young girl who arrived and grows up alongside her Chinese best friend, Lee, whose family are Chinese medicine practitioners, and comes to learn the local culture. So she's trying to hang on to her Jewish culture. She's learning about the Chinese culture, and she's learning, of course, how to get on in the world as a refugee, how to make a life for yourself, how to look after the ones around you, what is your duty, how do I begin again? And I ended up talking to a number of refugees, people who'd been former refugees in Shanghai, one in Samushinsky, who was a Russian refugee from the revolution. His family came out, and they were in the French concession. They were a very wealthy family who lived in the French concession, and he very kindly read my manuscript and told me tales of growing up in the French concession, and he was very close to his ama, and who showed him a lot of the, I guess, the streets of Shanghai and the food, and he spoke Chinese fluently. He spoke five languages, actually, as a child growing up in the French concession. And he gave me the name of Horst Eisfelder, who lived in the Shanghai ghetto. He was a little boy in the Shanghai ghetto. And when I gave my manuscript to Horst to read, and they were enormously helpful, checking facts. I mean, we shouldn't talk about fact checking now. It's not a cool thing, but they actually did read through my manuscript. But they also, in speaking to them, I learned much more about what it means to be a refugee, what it means, because they have, of course, been refugees twice, once in Shanghai and again in Australia. And many of those people in Shanghai ended up in America, so many. And so they became, I wouldn't say adept, but they certainly have a worldliness and a groundedness and a sense of themselves and community that they are able to reestablish themselves in a new world, not once but twice. And I learned not only about their life in Shanghai, but just their generosity and wisdom and the pride in the way they talked about their families and about community and what their duty to give back to their community. And so I went to them for facts, but I learned much more about ways to move through the world. And it was those characteristics that I really fed back into my characters of Romy and Lee. So, extraordinary people,
right,
so generous.
Right.
Yeah.
When you answered your publisher about whether you had another book in you, and you put together the proposal and then wrote the book that was spot on the proposal, as you said, as you started writing out that proposal, did the events of the book just start unfolding for you? How did I guess the complexity of the story, because it is a pretty complex book, did you just have a grasp of all that to begin with?
I did.
That's amazing.
I had a really clear idea. Alexandra, my contemporary character, I wanted to give her a job that really kind of encapsulated modern Shanghai. So she is a commodities trader, and I mean, there's no bigger center of commodities in the world, I think, than Shanghai at the moment. It's a port where people come in and out and commodities come in and out. And I wanted to capture, the current dilemmas that go with that. And also she is partly Chinese, and she is adopted, or her mother was adopted. She wasn't adopted. But her parents are dead. So there's a bit of a who am I story in there, a bit of a mystery as she goes to Shanghai, of course, looking for her own origins. And it's only when she's there that she uncovers the origins of her Jewish grandparents. So it's an incidental story where she learns much more than she bargained for about the history. Because I think it's a common thing in families. I gave a talk last week. It was a week commemorating Holocaust here in Australia, and I think probably in America too. And last week, and I gave a number of talks, and there were a lot of Holocaust survivors there who came up and were really moved afterwards. And they said, you know, we're so touched that you are, as a non-Jewish person, you've taken such an interest in our story and to tell our history, and people are starting to ask about our stories now. And I think, I don't know whether it's time passing, but it feels like people are ready to talk and ready to share, or maybe it's something about the state of the world at the moment. It's very chaotic. I mean, it's election day here in Australia at the moment, and so we're voting for a new prime minister. And, can be very conflicting for people, because it brings up some red hot passions. So I think all of those questions we ask ourselves, who are we? What do we believe in? What does it mean to be generous as a person? What does it mean to be generous as a country? I think there's something in the air that we're all kind of asking those questions at the moment around the world, aren't we? Well,
I think so too. And, over the last year or two specifically, there has been such a boom in historical fiction, especially around this time period and around these places in the world. And I've asked that question several times. Why do you think we're talking about this so much right now? And why do people have such a passion for these stories and for these people from this time period? What is it that's... And I wonder if it's all the things that you said, but, you know, we're also getting farther away from the event itself. And the farther away we get from something, the more it gets reduced to just bullet points, you know, in history class. Because we just can't cover everything. So the farther we get away from something, it just gets reduced down and we lose the people and their stories. And maybe that's what's, maybe we're realizing that we're losing these stories. And as the people that live there get older and are, you know, passing every day, we're in danger of losing the real plot of what happened.
And I think there is that. And it was interesting at this talk I gave last week, they had one of the Holocaust survivors introduce me, Sam Ashinsky, who did a very generous introduction. And he was talking about the difference between fiction and nonfiction, because he, of course, has written a memoir of his time in Shanghai, and many people now, as they are in America, are going through a process of either telling or writing their stories. So they're recording it in some manner. And he said, you know, he sees, he was delighted to help with a fictional story, because he said, you know, in memoir and when you're reading nonfiction, you are getting a lot of the facts. They're telling you this happened and this happened and this happened. He said, but in fiction, you create that empathy with a character, people. And I think in Australia, as in America and other parts of the world, there's still big ongoing question marks over refugees, how many should be allowed in what form, how they should be, I guess, managed. And in Australia, it's quite controversial because it's obviously it's difficult to arrive here as a refugee. A lot of our refugees come by boat and there are detention centres, and it's very distressing. It's a very distressing subject for everyone involved. And I felt like if I wrote a nonfiction story or I wrote an essay about the plight of refugees and the reason they would come to Australia and seek a new life and why they deserve that, I mean, it was really struck with, I was struck very hard back when I was in Shanghai. I was there with my three small children. Look at this statue of a small child on the shoulder of a father. And I'm like, here I am traveling around the world with my children. We can go pretty much anywhere we like. We're free. And but I was also thinking, what wouldn't I do for my children? You know, if Australia was invaded, if our freedom was threatened, if their safety was threatened, I really found myself asking what I would do to keep my children safe. And I think through a book, somebody who might be against the political idea of a refugee, but if you give them a story of one family and one set of circumstances that people left and the struggles they went through and their emotions and their feelings, they can identify with that person. They can imagine themselves in that person's shoes, or they really feel something. They connect with that character, and then you're not being didactic. I don't think books answer questions. I think books raise lots of questions. But if a book is making you think about this in a different way than you might have otherwise, like a fiction novel can challenge your beliefs or ask you to look into a different person's life and spend some time there and imagine how that would feel, I think that's a wonderful thing if you can do that in fiction.
Well, and that's the power of fiction, I think, that nonfiction gives us the information, but fiction helps us to put a face on it and to connect with the details of what happened with our heart and not necessarily just our mind. Fiction allows us to I think it allows us to exercise empathy, to put ourselves in those people's shoes.
I know. I mean, if you look at, as you say, I mean, we're talking about it now, To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch says that very thing, and you're from the Deep South. I've been to America, but I've never been to the South, but there is no way you can read To Kill a Mockingbird and not have your heart torn out and know and just rage against the injustice of it. And I think that's an extraordinary thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. We mentioned earlier your love of these dual timelines. In this book, we get to live through different characters in different time spaces with the two different timelines. What was your did you always know that it would be that way, that you would have a story surrounding a story? And was there ever any doubt about pulling that off?
Yeah. I'll answer the second one first. Yes, so much doubt, Hank, so much doubt. I think writing, I like the technical challenge of trying to write in multiple time frames. I'm just in the throes of putting together my third book, and it's quite the jigsaw puzzle. And it is a bit like that, because you're writing essentially, they have to be two very fulfilling stories, and they have to be complete in themselves, but also spliced together with the complementary story, the second story, so the historical and the contemporary. And I just love when I'm writing, it just means I never get bored. If I'm not feeling the contemporary character, and if I'm struggling a bit with the contemporary storyline, I can switch over into the historical and lose myself on a street in Shanghai. And it just, I think my mind is a bit frenetic in that way. It just kind of works for me, having something that I can always go on with, that I can always polish. And if I'm stuck, there's always another part of the story or thread plot line I can go to work on that and nut that out until I'm ready to come back. And sometimes, and towards the end of the book, you don't really know how it's coming together. You do a bit. I mean, I know I said I wrote the synopsis, but I didn't actually know how I was going to pull that off. And I don't always know the twist in the book or how a mystery is going to be resolved. I have an idea of what the ending, the exact ending might be, but all the bits that happen between, they're all a bit of a mystery to me too. And a couple of the key scenes for Song of the Jade Lily I actually wrote in just the week before I sent it to my publishers. I was like, I've got to change this. And then it's kind of like a momentum builds as the threads, you kind of start stitching all the pieces of the puzzle together. And then finally there's two big squares, linking squares that are missing, and only when you've done all the other work can you work out what those two bits should be. And I find it enormously challenging and enormously rewarding. I love it, and I just have to trust the process and know that I have to stick to, be disciplined, you know, really make sure they're tight pieces that really cover what needs to be covered, but also leave a little leeway for some of the mystery to be shown in the other storyline. So, yeah.
Well, it's so much fun. It, you know, it really ramps up the tension and the mystery as we're, you know, we're along for the ride as the characters are digging into their past and finding out things. We are right along with them, and it's so much fun to write a book that way.
And I think family secrets, and I think, you know, uncovering people's stories, and our, you were talking about, we're just delving back into history now, but going back into your parents' stories and your grandparents' stories and multiple generations. I mean, it just strikes me how much we do manufacture our own stories, what we tell to our friends and what we tell to our family and what our families tell each other and what they conceal. from one another too. I find that fascinating.
Well, yeah, and you know, there's we mentioned it a little bit earlier about this desire to know your own history, and there's one thing to understand the world around us and kind of the big set pieces and try to understand why things happen the way they do. But when you can narrow that down to your family story, that's amazing. And they're like being along with Alexandra as this is unfolding and she's making discoveries for herself. That's all of our desire is to know more about where we come from and to feel connected with the past.
I think there is, and I think I haven't done it, but I've actually been thinking about doing one of the the blood tests you can do that give you your origin. I thought that would be a fascinating thing to I've had quite a few of my friends do it with quite unexpected results. They found out, you know, everything from their parentage was different to their thought, and their racial background was completely different to what they expected. And so, you know, there have been stories concealed in their families along the way, and I'm just happily taking notes over coffee.
Exactly.
As I reveal these. But, you know, it can be quite a shock. I mean, I don't know how accurate those tests are, but a number of people have asked me lately, have you done that? I said no.
Well, you know, as writers, we really ought to pay to have all of our friends do it, because that is story material for now and to the end of the world, you know?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, Kirsten, I absolutely love the book, The Song of the Jade Lily. It's out everywhere now. It's in Kindle edition audiobook and available in trade paperback. Like I said earlier, I've had my copy for about a month now, but it's finally on sale officially everywhere. And I'm going to send everybody to pick up a copy of this book. I absolutely love it. If people are just learning about you and want to learn more about what you do and what's coming up next and, you know, dig into your back catalog and stuff, is there a place they can connect with you online?
They can. They can go to my Instagram page, Kirsty Manning AU, or my website, which is kirstymanning.com, and send me an email or send me a message. I'd love to hear. I've been getting so many, many amazing messages from people, and they all, you know, so many of them say the same thing, and the reviews as well. Lots of people say they just had no idea of the Jewish background in Shanghai. And sometimes somebody will say a family member was there, my mother was there, my aunt was there, we did know a little about it. And the other thing people often write to me to say is, we've just booked a holiday to Shanghai. can you recommend some places to go and eat? So maybe I should throw some of that up on my website. But, I mean, you can't foot it wrong.
Right. Well, from the provocative cover, if the cover doesn't get you, the first chapter will. This book is amazing. Kirsty, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show with me early this morning for you.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here from the future and from Australia. It's I am loving it, and I'm loving the feedback from America. They're just being so typically generous and big-hearted. So thanks to all of you. It's amazing.
We're going to send everybody to see you. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Kirsty.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The year was 1834. The month was December. I was 14. Irving's tale was by then well known. The characters of Brom Bones and the beauteous Katrina were widely understood in town to refer to my parents. Rumors persisted. I heard the name of Headless Horseman whispered. My father dismissed all these tales, calling them malicious. Yet more than once I saw him and my mother scanning Agatha's face across the supper table, finding only a secret smile and a look of defiance. I found the rumors fascinating. I followed Agatha like a pup, waiting for her to cast some magic spell. And one day she did. The household servants had set a fire in the hearth for her comfort, and she sat close to it, counting out small gold coins upon a lap board. I hid in the shadows, hoping she might drop a coin and I could retrieve it for myself. One of her servants, a West Indian girl, carried a snowy log into the room and set it on the fire. It began to hiss and pop. The snow melted, and the fire sputtered out. Agatha cursed, as I had never heard her do before. She stood, spilling all the gold, and slapped the idiot girl across the face. The girl ran, and my grandmother muttered to herself, searching for match and tong to no avail. When she was not looking, I crept forward and took for myself one of the gold pieces. Then something remarkable occurred. My grandmother sighed, knelt before the fireplace, reached for the logs, and her right hand caught a fire. Flame blossomed and coiled about her wrist. I gasped and cried out,
"Shh! Don't be afraid, my Dylan."
"Your hand!" She raised her palm. Flame sat cupped in it, casting the shadow of her fingers upon the ceiling and walls.
"Lock the door," she said.
I obeyed. She pointed to the floor, and I sat, waiting breathlessly.
"This is the Van Brunt gift. It will be your gift as well, soon, and your children's forever afterwards."
"Why does it not burn you?" I asked.
"Why should it? Do I deserve to be burned?"
"No."
"Then I am safe from the fire. Do you deserve to be burned, my Dylan?"
I shook my head.
"Show me."
I reached for the flame and took it. I pulled back at once, crying out with pain, wagging my fingertips. The fire caught my sleeve. I could not rid myself of it, as if I clutched burning tar. The pain intensified. The blisters broke, and a rivulet of lymph ran down my arm.
"Your conscience knows, Dylan. You deserved to be burned. Say it."
"I deserved to be burned," said I.
"Again."
"I deserved to be burned." She turned her palm.
"The gold piece."
I nodded and brought the stolen coin from my pocket. She took it and raised it to the light.
"You cannot wield the flame with guilt in your heart, son. Try, and it will devour you. Do you understand?"
I nodded.
"A Van Brunt should not be so weak."
"I'm sorry I took the gold, grandmother. I'm sorry I was bad. Don't be ashamed of me." She frowned and laid the gold coin on her lapboard. She shook her head sadly.
"I'm not ashamed that you took the gold. I'm ashamed that you felt the guilt.